I have a couple of observations about what you've said and what I've heard other people say, and I'd like to get your reaction to it. Going back to Lexington, Kentucky, you made a comment about the general public that attended these school board sessions, mm-hmm. and how some of them were shocked that their ministers were not creationists. Mm-hmm. And one of the themes that I've heard around this whole general topic is the simple lack of education in religion.
Mm.
Of the general public. In fact, I think there have been some fairly, not even with the evolutionist versus creationist, but just some general comments made, and even a book published recently, I think, about how sadly uneducated people are about their own religion.
Mm-hmm. And other people's.
And other people's, but even,
but especially
their own.
Absolutely.
I mean, and coming from the Christian perspective, I think I've heard that, over 50% can't name the first five books of the Bible.
Yeah.
I mean, just very, very...
Who gave the Sermon
basic.
On the Mount?
Yes, things like that. So that's one thing I'd like to get your reaction on. The second thing is, the second argument in the trial you just took us through...
Let's just do one thing at a time. I can't keep
two
things in my brain anymore.
Okay,
I've been at a conference for 3 days, and so I don't know anything. No, I mean, absolutely.
We have very low rates of science literacy. We have really low rates of theological literacy. And, I couldn't agree more. I mean, people don't even understand their own religion. This is true of both mainstream Christians as well as the, quote, Bible-believing Christians. Bible-believing Christians don't necessarily read the Bible. You know, this is a problem. Because the kinds of surveys you're talking about were done also on conservative Christians as well as what would be considered mainstream Christians. And everybody's ignorant. As coming from an anthropological background, I would very, very much like to see comparative religion being taught in the schools. I realize that that is a real problem because history and social studies teachers really don't have any background in it. In order to have that happen, we would have to retool the educational training at the university level of people who become social studies or history teachers. That's not impossible, but it would require that to happen. It would also require very careful counseling, and it would also require that the teachers themselves really understand in absolutely black and white terms that they're talking about religion. They are not advocating any particular religion over others or any particular component of one religion over others. That this is a descriptive fashion. You can't say Jesus was right or you can't say Buddha was right. I mean, you're talking about religion. And that would be great because especially nowadays, we're getting so many people coming to the United States from countries where Christianity is not the major religion. We've got obviously a lot of, we don't have a very large Islamic population, but we have, regionally in different parts of the country, and the San Francisco Bay Area where I come from, down in the South Bay you have a lot of Southeast Asians, lots of Vietnamese, lots of Thai. Those people are not predominantly Christians, right? And so it would be very useful if Americans had a much broader understanding of world religions. But, like I say, I'm an anthropologist, so I kind of keep coming back to this idea that religion is more than just Christianity. And it's more than just the Middle Eastern monotheisms either. And it's more than just their world religions. It's also things like the wide variety of religious beliefs among Native Americans or sub-Saharan Africans or tribal people of India or other parts of the world. So if we're going to understand religion, we really need to understand it from the ground up, not just the difference between Catholics and Protestants. We need to understand why religion is so important to people and why it is such a cultural universal. There's many, many reasons why religion is found in every human society. We need to understand more about that. We don't understand it now, and I'd like to see more of it. So I think you and I are right on the same page on that one.
Well, I have a feeling we will be on the second one, too, because you mentioned that the second part of the trial was an argument about teaching critical thinking, quote-unquote, around evolution and the pros and cons, or some sort of wording along that line. And I've also heard a theme advocated by really all parties involved in that schools should teach more critical thinking.
Absolutely,
And that seems to be missing from the curriculum, and there seems to be less understanding of the critical thinking process and how to come to logical conclusions.
Well, that's not entirely true. The state science standards around the country, and this state and all other states, all have a section of the standards having to do with habits of mind or science as a way of knowing, you know, the critical thinking skills and stuff like that. So it's in all of the standards. Schools are supposed to be teaching scientific reasoning, which really is kind of the essence of critical thinking when you come right down to it. Whether this is being done well is another problem. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that, I mean, to me, the buck stops at the university. And this is an ex-university professor speaking, right? My colleagues at the university are doing a lousy job of teaching thinking. Most university science instruction still, in 2008, still is memorize the facts. Here are the facts and concepts. These are the discoveries. This is what the consensus view of science is. Now you learn it and tell me what it is at the end of the semester, and then you will have passed the class. There's very little attention paid to how do we know? You know, continents move. How do we know continents move? Well, you don't tell people how we know continents move. You just tell them that they move. And here's Gondwana land, and here's all the other, and here they are in the Devonian, and here they are in the Cenozoic. How do we know they move, and what are the mechanisms that make them? Well, they get into the seafloor spreading, so you find about the but how do we know about seafloor spreading? I mean, we don't spend anywhere nearly as much time talking about science as a process. We don't spend nearly as much time in the college level teaching our students that all of these conclusions that we are giving you came about because they were actually tested. And somebody really figured out how to find out whether that really was the best explanation by eliminating these other kinds of options. And how do you do that? Instead, we just give people a list of conclusions. And then we're really surprised when high school teachers don't teach that way. Oh, they're bad.
But we need to be teaching that way at the high school level, too, because there's a whole lot of people who never get into college.
Oh, absolutely. But who teaches the high school teachers?
That's true.
That's the point. That is the point I wanted to make. Yeah. The college teachers teach the high school teachers. They are not doing a very good job teaching the high school teachers. So why are we beating up on high school teachers for not doing the job that they haven't been taught? Is that too many negatives in there?
No, I think I followed that.
Is that primarily because college teachers, I taught at the university too, the college teachers are too insular in their specialties. They don't know, most of them don't know anything about their colleagues' specialties.
You know, what's interesting...
They don't bother. They don't try to. They're not interested.
But especially teaching the science as a way of knowing, you know, the critical thinking, how do we know what we know, what's the method of science. That kind of instruction, my experience has been that there is an inverse scale on the, quote, hardness of the science, which I think is a stupid term, but, you folks on the radio listen to the quotation marks around the word hardness. Physics and chemistry tend to be the sciences where the least amount of attention is paid to how science works. I mean, these are the oldest scientific fields, and I think this is my hypothesis, that the scientists in these fields just sort of assume that students will pick up by osmosis how science works, which is why physicists and chemists tend to be the most clueless about philosophy of science, quite frankly. Geologists are somewhat better. Biologists know a little bit more about, are more consciously dealing with philosophy of science, is what I mean, in their classes, you know, spending more time on how we know what we know. Partly because, well, maybe then. And when you get into the social sciences, feels like anthropology, they totally obsess about science. I mean, every anthropology course I ever took in college and every one I ever taught in college just obsessed over, you know, this is the scientific method, this is how we do science. So I think it's not a surprise that we don't know very much about science. Let me give you a for instance. Every 2 years, the National Science Board commissions a survey. It's called Science and Engineering Indicators. These are all online. You can find them. Just Google Science and Engineering Indicators. They're fascinating studies. And it's sort of a survey of where we are in terms of science and engineering in the United States. And one chapter, the only one I ever read, has to do with a poll of science knowledge and knowledge about how science works. And these data go every 2 years for like 10 years now, more than that. And they ask a question of adult Americans. It's properly sampled and weighted and the whole works. They ask a question about how science works. Give people an example. And the example is you want to test a drug to see if it's efficacious for controlling diabetes. How would you do this? Would you take 1,000 people with diabetes and give them the drug and see who gets better? See how many get better. Or would you take 1,000 people with diabetes and give 500 of them the drug and don't give the drug to the other 500 and see if there's any difference? Now, which do you think is the more scientific way of answering that question? One or two? Ladies and gentlemen?
Good.
You got 100% right here. Only 46% of Americans picked the right answer. Now, that to me seems like such an easy question, right? But, you know, a majority of our fellow citizens, who each have one vote, okay, we have to remember that. A majority of our fellow citizens don't know that the most, you know, the big idea of a scientific explanation is holding constant certain variables and
I'd
testing.
Like to see Congress,
yeah,
given that test,
they would do better. Believe it or not, you know, people in Congress are better educated. They know better. They just don't act it.
They didn't even have a placebo group on
that. Well, that is, yeah. One 500 of them. We're not given the drug. That's the placebo. Oh, placebo. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's a control. But yeah, well, whatever. You can usually calculate the placebo effect.
Okay.
You know, we need to spend a lot more time helping people understand what science actually is. And, you know, like I say, I beat up on college professors all the time because I think they need to be doing a better job. Now, the good news is that especially with the physicists, interestingly enough, about 20 years ago, the physics community began to realize the way they were teaching wasn't working. Because they found out that the students would get high grades on, you know, mechanics or optics and these basic freshman physics kinds of topics. But if they went back and tested them three months later or 6 months later or a year later, no retention whatsoever. They hadn't a clue what these things were. And this was very depressing for the physicists because, you know, this is what they were really hoping that they were making a difference. So physicists did some really serious soul searching on how do you teach these topics better. And they actually worked with the high school teachers to develop some more, as they call it, constructivist methods where, you know, it's not that you make the student discover the principle of mass or anything like that, but where you make the student confront his misconceptions and make him work through those misconceptions and guide him to the, you know, correct understanding of a phenomenon. And that sticks. If you just sort of, you know, like with a, you know, gravy ladle, if you just pour the correct answer on top of the misconception, you know, once the gravy trickles off, the misconception remains, and you haven't made any changes. So they began to develop these constructivist ways of teaching these principles in physics, and they're finding much better results. Now, it's trickling over into biology and geology, but the progress has been slow. But you got to believe in evolution in that context. Okay? I never use the phrase believe in evolution, as you all know. We don't believe evolution, we accept evolution. But in this context, I have to believe in evolution. The science education will evolve to be better.
You are listening to Humanism Today on Citywide Radio's Wider Horizons Hour on WIDE 99.1 in Madison. We continue now with the concluding part of the program.
Since Dover, your book here, which you edited and contributed to, Not in Our Classrooms, Why Intelligent Design is Wrong for Our Schools, the foreword mentions that right after the Dover decision, there was a case in California, Lebec, California case. You want to briefly mention what they were doing there?
Yeah. Well, that was another one of these school board situations. Literally a couple of days after Dover, I got a call from Richard Katsky, with whom we had worked. He was the guy with Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And by the way, one of the finest legal writers ever. Certainly the best legal writer I've ever known. He's the one that drafted virtually all of our legal documents, and just a phenomenal writer. But we had actually been working with a group of people down in this community in Southern California who were very unhappy that an intra-session, the four-week session between the fall and the spring semesters, an intra-session course was being offered by one of the... why are they all coaches? by the volleyball coach. Something like that, yeah. That was called Philosophy of Intelligent Design. And, the outline of the class was creation science. I mean, they were talking about challenging radiometric dating, about gaps in the fossil record, even thermodynamics was in there. I mean, it's just classic creation science. They had just relabeled it intelligent design. And then, hoping to avoid the... somebody had said, that's illegal to teach that in science classes. Okay, so we'll call it Philosophy of Intelligent Design, and then it won't be a science class. Wrong. If it's unconstitutional in a science class, it's going to be unconstitutional in a social studies class. You just can't do that. So we had been working with some people in the community, and when it got to a certain state, we referred them to Americans United, and actually we had plenty of other things to do, so I kind of forgot about these poor guys down there in Lebec. And so I get a call from Richard, and Richard says, guess what? They're going ahead with this course, and we're going to write them a letter. Well, we've written them a letter. They haven't responded. We're going to file suit, and can you help? Well, of course I'll help. And so to make a long story short, we did. AU wrote up a very good brief. Katsky always does good briefs. I wrote an expert statement and all this kind of stuff. And a geologist member of NCSC became first plaintiff in Hearst v. Newman. And so AU swatted him with this, suit saying, it was basically a cease and desist, only that's not the proper legal term for it, saying, don't teach this class or you will be in violation. Don't do this and it's going to cost you a whole lot of money. And basically, they ended up settling out of court. The school district realized that this was a really dumb thing to do. And so they, in the settlement agreement, they promised never to teach intelligent design, never to denigrate evolution in this fashion, and whether in a science class, a philosophy class, anything like this. So Hearst was obviously another successful outcome. But it was just sort of like, we just finished Dover. The judge's decision was announced on like December 20th, which around our office is referred to as Kitsmas. December 20th, the Kitzmiller versus Dover decision came down, and like 2 days later, I was writing another expert report. Give me a break. Can I even catch my breath here? So, I don't know. It doesn't stop. It doesn't stop.
There was a Peabody Award-winning PBS.
Yes, we were so
Judgment
pleased.
Judgment Day Intelligent Design on Trial, which was shown last November. Mm-hmm. But I understand that some PBS stations thought it was too controversial to air.
I didn't hear much of that.
I saw a figure. The Memphis station later broadcast it, but they had on their website that 15% of PBS stations nationwide did not air it.
I didn't realize it was that high. Mm. That's interesting, Bob. I had to look that back up. I didn't realize it was that high a percentage.
Of course, if there were enough public complaints, the stations may have later aired it.
And I think some of them, in fact, we do know some of them that didn't, which is, maybe we only know the ones that did air it again, so it didn't seem like such a high number to me. But and I was delighted when a week or so ago it was announced that it did win a Peabody, so that's really great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were advisors to that.
Did you appear aspects in that?
Yeah. Uh-huh. In that movie, they reenacted the trial scenes because, of course, there were no cameras in the trial. And the court TV was not allowed to film it, which I guess in a way was too bad. But I wasn't terribly unhappy. So, but it was such a dramatic trial. I mean, it really was. And if you do go to ncseweb.org and look at the transcript, you will find all kinds of really gripping kinds of stuff. So they wanted to bring some of that testimony into the documentary. And, how do we do it? Well, okay, so we hire some actors. And, of course, we had great giggles over their attempt to find actors who kind of looked a little bit like the witnesses. And they did pretty well with Ken Miller, and they did pretty well with Michael Behe. They failed totally with Barbara Forrest because she has this wonderful accent from Louisiana, which I can't possibly do. And the actress who played her just didn't even try, which kind of spoiled the whole thing. Because, here's this Southern belle kind of going through this very dignified middle-aged woman who's has this very nice, sweet Southern accent, and she's just completely eviscerating intelligent design. It was just quite wonderful to hear. And Kevin Padian, who is another one of our science witnesses, is well known for his thick, curly hair. He's a man in his, probably late 50s or so, graying, but very, very mop head. And they put this terrible gray wig on this actor. It just so as soon as he came on, we all just hit the floor. It was just very funny. I actually was able to see Judgment Day in November when it first aired. It's been airing off and on in stations around the country. I always know that it's aired because I get an email from somebody saying, "Hey, I turned on the TV the other day, and there you were." Oh, they must have shown Judgment Day again. But the first showing, the premiere, if you will, was in November, like you said, and we decided to do a Kitzmiller reunion. We've had reunions. We had a reunion in 06 and 07, and now we're having. Wrong year. We had one in 06 and then in 07 last fall in November. We decided to have another one. And what better time than on Judgment Day's release? So I was really, really excited to be able to watch Judgment Day with the plaintiffs and not the plaintiffs. With the plaintiffs, with the citizens in Dover and the legal team, and a couple of the expert witnesses came down to us. We really had a blast. It was really fun. Very, very special moment.
Well, now there's a new media
event,
the movie Expelled, which is about to be released.
Yes.
There were some earlier showings for special audiences. I remember reading about Richard Dawkins seeing one, and was it Minneapolis?
That was such a wonderful story, yeah. Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, is the new Ben Stein, quote, documentary, quote. Documentaries are supposed to be factual. That's why it has to be in quotation marks. And this is an attack on science. It's a pro-intelligent design movie that attacks scientists and the scientific establishment. There's four claims in the movie. The first claim is that big science, as they call it, the scientific establishment is beating up on intelligent design, on the intelligent design proponents who are being
cruelly discriminated against. They are losing their jobs. They are getting sacked. They're not being able to publish, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they have a whole series of martyrs that they trot out there. It's the usual martyrs, actually. The second point is really offensive to a lot of people. The claim, and you can find this almost as a direct quote on the website, there is a direct link between atheism, Darwin, evolution, eugenics, and the Holocaust.
Oh my.
And so, obviously, evolution is this terrible idea, and it's also, and third theme, evolution is wrong. You know, evolution is bad science. It's really, you know, an idea that's on its way out. This 19th century relic, which is almost ready to be abandoned. And then the fourth theme is that intelligent design is this wonderful, valid new science, Shades of Dover, that deserves to be given its day in the sun. As if we haven't already looked at these arguments. We've been looking at these arguments for 15 years now. No, they haven't come up with anything new. And a lot of the scientific community, I'd say the majority of the scientific community, has just decided, been there, done that. We've already told them for 15 years what's wrong with their stuff. We're not going to pay attention to them anymore. But this now is discrimination, you know, that we're being ignored. Well, yeah, you're being ignored because you're not building your theory. Go and do some research and then we'll talk. So somehow Ben Stein, who has the reputation of being a smart guy, he somehow got, you know, snookered into this, making this creationist movie, which is a big surprise to a lot of people. And he seems to have swallowed this line about the relationship between atheism and Darwin and the Holocaust and all of this. And that's just baloney. You know, it's just ridiculous scholarship. So it's being produced by a company called Premise Media, which is a Canadian filmmaking company. They've got a ton of money. They're promoting this movie through a firm called Motive Marketing. Motive Marketing is the company that marketed Passion of the Christ and Chronicles of Narnia through what they call viral marketing, which means that you have a lot of preview showings before you have your big opening. And in these preview showings, as they did with Passion of the Christ, they showed it in churches and to especially religiously conservative audiences to get up a big buzz about this wonderful new, you know, Mel Gibson movie that was coming out. And therefore, when they had the opening, they had a huge opening. Lots and lots of these people who'd been to the previews came to see, you know, the Mel Gibson movie. Passion of the Christ. And of course, the first weekend of Passion of the Christ was huge. And it went on to have a very long a stay in the theaters. You know, there was this big buzz about it. And of course, it continues to be shown on DVDs in church basements for years. Now, they're having the same kind of experience, or trying to recreate the same kind of experience with Expelled. They've showed it at least 90 times over the last several months to largely religiously conservative audiences, with the goal of building up a big buzz so that on opening weekend, which is April 18th, 19th, and 20th, guess when? Today is opening night, ladies and gentlemen, that it will get a huge outpouring of attendance. And then on Monday, when the statistics for the movie attendance for movies opening that weekend, and also for movie attendance in general, they'll be right up on the top. You know, they'll be at least in the top 10. That's the goal, because that will give the movie legs. That will keep it in the theaters for a long time, which of course will bring in more money. But you know, the longer it's in the theaters, the more people are going to see it, and so forth and so on. This is a fundamentally dishonest and deceptive movie. The content of the movie is dishonest and deceptive, and I'll just refer you to NCSE's new website, expelledexposed.com, just like it sounds. Expelledexposed.com. Spend a little time, you'll find out why this is a dishonest and deceptive movie. And one of the, you know, easiest examples of why it's dishonest and deceptive is how they got me and a number of other scientists to participate in the movie. And this is also in more detail on the website. But We were contacted by a man named Mark Mathis, who said he was with a company called Rampant Films. He was making a movie called Crossroads, which was a very generic creation and evolution movie, and would I please be, could he interview me? I do that all the time. People are always doing documentaries on creation and evolution. I mean, this is almost a cottage industry out there. Most of them actually don't get made, but, you know, I've been interviewed a lot of times. There was nothing really suspicious about the whole relationship there. We find out a couple months later, au contraire, it wasn't Rampant Films, which, near as we can tell, is just a trumped-up website that's not a real company whatsoever. Mark Mathis really is a person. He came out and interviewed me. The film is not called Crossroads. It's called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. And it's not a generic creationism and evolution movie. It's an anti-science movie. It's a pro-intelligent design movie. Now, why did he lie to me? I would have been willing to be interviewed anyway. Michael Shermer would have been willing to be interviewed anyway. P.Z. Myers would have been willing to be interviewed anyway. Rob Pennock was interviewed, by the way. But he didn't give the right answer, so we ended up on the cutting room floor, you see. Richard Dawkins probably would not have been interviewed, because he was treated very poorly by creationists once, and so he just refuses to be interviewed for any creationist program. So I suspect the reason why they lied to all of us is so they could get Richard. I mean, you know, if somebody came to me and said, we're making a creationist movie, here's what it's all about, I'd say, fine, you know, I expect you to present my view accurately so that, you know, don't distort my position, you know, and let's go. Because that's what that to me is what balance means. You know, that you get, it's okay if they disagree with me, but they need to present my position honestly. And, you know, I have been treated honestly like that. I also, by the way, since I'm not anti-religious, I don't say dumb things bashing religion. So, you know, that doesn't show up on camera because I don't believe it, so I don't say it. But I'm also pretty careful about how I phrase things. I don't give them a lot that they can, you know, that they can cut and twist around. So, you know, that works out too. But so when confronted with this, after the movie was announced, and we all came back and said, hey, what happened to Crossroads? Mark Mathis says, oh, that was just the working title. We just changed. It's not at all uncommon for them to for movie makers to change the title. True. That is true. Titles do sometimes get changed. That's understandable. Except, why a month before you interviewed me did you get the domain name expelledthemovie.com? That's a little suspicious. And why is it that a couple of years before you started taping, you were pitching to Ben Stein the concept of a movie that would go after the scientific establishment for beating up on these poor intelligent design guys, which Ben Stein has admitted in an interview. So how come Mark Mathis didn't know all this? Either Premise Media lied to Mark Mathis, or Mark lied to us. I think I have an idea which of that is true. But, you know, this is a very, you know, they were deceptive to us. They also seem to be pretty numb about things like copyright. If you get this on DVD, which is what I encourage you to do, trust me, there'll be plenty of free DVDs around. You know, they're going to be distributing this thing like popcorn to all the Christian churches around the country. See it on DVD. Don't give them your money. But when you see this movie, if you see this movie, you will find that they use a lot of pop music in it. Now, I confess to be about 98% ignorant of popular music, but I understand the Killers are quite the deal. And I know John Lennon is quite the deal. They've got a passage from John Lennon's Imagine, you know, and no religion too. Remember that line? Mm-hmm. Okay, so they've got this little snippet from John Lennon. They've got a thing from the Killers. They've got something from Pink Floyd. I've got some other pop music things in there. Apparently, they never really bothered getting Yoko Ono's permission to use that that little clip in there. Yoko Ono's not pleased. And she's starting to fuss a little bit. I don't know what'll come of it. The Killers are mad. They searched through their records and they found that, according to a blog post I read recently, which had a quote, that a number of months ago, yes, they agreed to allow whatever song it was to be used in a movie about discrimination of higher education against creationists, a satirical movie about the discrimination in higher education against new scientific ideas, starring the actor and comedian Ben Stein, or something to that effect. That's not a direct quote, but that's pretty close. Well, if they had known how this music would have been used, it is very doubtful that they would have allowed. So the whole thing is deceptive. I mean, the content, the background, the setup, it's really very, Ben Stein keeps saying about one of the martyrs, Rick Sternberg lost his job because he proposed ID. Well, no, he never lost his job. And that's just wrong. He never lost his job. And you can read all about this on expelledexposed.com. It's a very frustrating movie, but the question is this just going to be a movie that will rev up the bass, or is this movie going to get any traction at all in the general American population? And that is, we don't really care if it revs up the bass. It makes things, gives me more work, but we can handle that. The concern that we would have is that there would be people who maybe ordinarily, wouldn't throw in their lot with the creationists, who would see this movie and think, oh my God, evolutionists are terrible people, which would be very unfortunate. On the other hand, it's, from all accounts, it's a very clunky movie in many ways. It does have, comedic elements, but if you read the reviews of this movie, the review in Variety, which is a very large magazine, the review in Variety just pans it. I mean, it just says, this is a terrible movie. The movie critic in the Orlando Sentinel, who attended one of these early previews that you were mentioning, Bob. The Orlando Sentinel reviewer, who is not a scientist, he's a movie critic, that's what he does. He thought it was a terrible movie. Basically, the secular press has thought it was really a crummy movie. Somebody told me that on RottenTomatoes.com, which is a movie review site, it's an aggregator of reviews, the total positive reviews on this is like 5%. this is the lowest ever. So BeliefNet, which is a very well-respected religion commentary site, BeliefNet said it was a terrible movie. So, well, Bill O'Reilly thinks it's great. So there's this bimodal distribution. The secular press thinks this is really a crummy movie, and the religious right or religious conservatives, they just think it's ducky. Well, we're all empiricists, are we not? We don't know how this is going to, how big a movie it's going to be. But I'll be watching the returns on Monday, I'll tell you that much.
Mm-hmm. We've been, there's been an effort to get the candidates for president to address science issues.
Yeah, yeah.
You were one of the signatories of the Science Debate 2008 effort, and their original goal was to have a debate of the three candidates today in Pennsylvania, was it? And that none of the candidates agreed to that.
Yeah, it's too bad. It really is unfortunate because, there are so many issues that are of importance to Americans and our government that involve science, that having a debate, we could have a whole debate on economic issues and nobody would think twice about it. Science is an even broader category than that. It's not like we're going to quiz them on, do you know the difference between the second and third laws of thermodynamics? That's not what this is all about. This is about, what is your policy about science when it comes to, any number of issues.
Space.
Go louder.
Medicine, space, on and on and on.
Agriculture, the environment. There's just lots of issues that we could... And this is a bipartisan deal. This is unquite. The people behind it include the people behind Science Debate 2008 are Democrats and Republicans and Independents. Nobody's got an axe to grind here. We just want to put science forward as an important issue that the American public should consider when it is deciding what candidate to vote for. I think that's a perfectly legitimate issue. Unfortunately, the all of the three major candidates extant right now have been very unforthcoming about cooperation. Too bad.
And they seem to ignore it, despite all the Nobel laureates who signed on to try and get them to address these issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What we need is a couple of big Republican, big Democrat donors to sign on.
Any other questions?
Why do you think they're afraid of science?
I think, I don't know for sure. I mean, they should really answer for themselves, and they are not answering at all. I don't know why they aren't willing to. Possibly they feel that if they have to make a statement about stem cells or medical research or how they would budget for research or something like that, this might be divisive, this might lose them votes or something like that. But I think the people who are trying to set up this debate are smart enough not to try to be too specific. I mean, one issue that should be discussed is, you know, to what degree would government agencies be given, would the scientists who work for government agencies be given the freedom to do unfettered research, unpoliticized research? Because this has been a major problem.
Or to publish the research that they come up with.
Yeah. And this totally is not edited. This is not just this administration. I mean, there were problems in the Clinton administration as well. Chris Mooney's written a book called The Republican War on Science, which he didn't like the title, but, you know, his publisher decided that would be the title. And Chris makes it clear in the book, it's not just a Republican problem, although it has been exacerbated a bit in the last 8 years. But you know, there were problems with Democratic administrations as well, leaning on government scientists to shade their results and their potentially publishable papers to fit some sort of policy that sort of came down from on high. And, you know, this is an issue that should be discussed, and we should get people on record as to how they feel about this.
How much of that do you think is the lack of good understanding of the people who were making the decisions and just politicizing?
I think it's politicizing. You know, people who get elected, especially senators, but members of the House as well, these are not stupid people. Well, they're not stupid at all. And they are not ignorant people. I mean, there's a difference between stupidity and ignorance, as we all know. One is curable. But they are not ignorant. They are almost uniformly college graduates. A high percentage of them have graduate degrees, many of them lawyers. But we have physicians. We even have a couple of scientists. So it's not as if they are unaware of science or its importance. I think that they just feel that this is a topic that they don't want to get involved in. I don't think many of them have advisors on science, and so they may not really know the issues as well. But you know, I think the Science Debate 2008 group has really done a service by trying to publicize the importance of science in the public discussion of how we should be governed. And maybe they didn't succeed this year, but maybe they'll succeed 4 years from now.